I know, Golan, that you are not fond of bliss, but for my sake I wish... Treviz raised a hand. One moment, Chenov. I am not overwhelmed by bliss, but neither is she an object of hatred to me. Actually, I have no animosity toward her at all. She's an attractive young woman, and even if she weren't, then for your sake I would be prepared to find her so. It's Gaia I dislike. But bliss is Gaia. I know, Genoff, that's what complicates things so. As long as I think of bliss as a person, there's no problem. If I think of her as Gaia, there is. But you haven't given Gaia a chance, Golan. Look, old chap, let me admit something. When Bliss and I are intimate, she sometimes lets me share her mind for a minute or so. Not for more than that, because she says I'm too old to adapt to it. Oh, don't grin, Golan. You would be too old for it, too. If an isolate, such as you or I, were to remain part of Gaia for more than a minute or two, there might be brain damage. And if it's as much as 5 or 10 minutes, it would be irreversible. If you could only experience it, Golan. What? Irreversible brain damage? No, thanks. Golan, you're deliberately misunderstanding me. I mean just that small moment of union. You don't know what you're missing. It's indescribable. Bliss says there's a sense of joy. That's like saying there's a sense of joy when you finally drink a bit of water after you have all but died of thirst. I couldn't even begin to tell you what it's like. You share all the pleasures that 1 billion people separately experience. It isn't a steady joy. If it were, you would quickly stop feeling it. It vibrates, twinkles, has a strange pulsing rhythm that doesn't let you go. It's more joy, no, not more, it's a better joy than you could ever experience separately. I could weep when she shuts the door on me. Treviz shook his head. You are amazingly eloquent, my good friend, but you sound very much as though you're describing pseudoendorphin addiction, or that of some other drug that admits you to joy in the short term at the price of leaving you permanently in horror in the long term. Not for me. I am reluctant to sell my individuality for some brief feeling of joy. I still have my individuality, Golan. But for how long will you have it if you keep it up, Genoff? You'll beg for more and more of your drug until eventually your brain will be damaged. Genoff, you mustn't let Bliss do this to you. Perhaps I had better speak to her about it. No, don't. You're not the soul of tact, you know, and I don't want her hurt. I assure you, she takes better care of me in that respect than you can imagine. She's more concerned with the possibility of brain damage than I am. You can be sure of that. Well, then, I'll speak to you. Genoff, don't do this anymore. You've lived for 52 years with your own kind of pleasure and joy, and your brain is adapted to withstanding that. Don't be snapped up by a new and unusual vice. There is a price for it. If not immediately, then eventually. Yes, Golan, said Pellerat in a low voice, looking down at the tips of his shoes. Then he said, suppose you look at it this way. What if you were a one-celled creature? I know what you're going to say, Genoff. Forget it. Bliss and I have already referred to that analogy. Yes, but think a moment. Suppose we imagine single-celled organisms with a human level of consciousness and with the power of thought, and imagine them faced with the possibility of becoming a multicellular organism. Would not the single-celled organisms mourn their loss of individuality and bitterly resent their forthcoming enforced regimentation into the personality of an overall organism? And would they not be wrong? Could an individual cell even imagine the power of the human brain? Trevise shook his head violently. No, Janoff, it's a false analogy. Single-celled organisms don't have consciousness or any power of thought. Or if they do, it is so infinitesimal it might as well be considered zero. For such objects to combine and lose individuality is to lose something they have never really had. A human being, however, is conscious and does have the power of thought. He has an actual consciousness and an actual independent intelligence to lose, so the analogy fails. There was silence between the two of them for a moment, an almost oppressive silence. And finally, Pellerat, attempting to wrench the conversation in a new direction, said, "Why do you stare at the view screen?" "Habit," said Trevise, smiling wryly. "The computer tells me that there are no Gaian ships following me, and that there are no Seychellian fleets coming to meet me. Still, I look anxiously, comforted by my own failure to see such ships, when the computer sensors are hundreds of times keener and more piercing than my eyes. What's more, the computer is capable of sensing some properties of space very delicately, properties that my senses can't perceive under any conditions. Knowing all that, I still stare." Pellerat said, "Golan, if we are indeed friends, I promise you I will do nothing to grieve Bliss, at least nothing I can help. It's another matter now. You keep your destination from me, as though you don't trust me with it. Where are we going? Are you of the opinion you know where Earth is?" Trevise looked up, eyebrows lifted. "I'm sorry. I have been hugging the secret to my own bosom, haven't I?" "Yes, but why?" Trevise said, "Why indeed? I wonder, my friend, if it isn't a matter of Bliss." "Bliss? Is it that you don't want her to know? Really, old fellow, she is completely to be trusted." "It's not that. What's the use of not trusting her? I suspect she can tweak any secret out of my mind if she wishes to. I think I have a more childish reason than that. I have the feeling that you are paying attention only to her and that I no longer really exist." Pellerat looked horrified. "But that's not true, Golan." "I know, but I'm trying to analyze my own feelings. You came to me just now with fears for our friendship, and thinking about it, I feel as though I've had the same fears. I haven't openly admitted it to myself, but I think I have felt cut out by Bliss. Perhaps I seek to get even by petulantly keeping things from you. Childish, I suppose." "Golan." "I said it was childish, didn't I? But where is the person who isn't childish now and then? However, we are friends. We've settled that, and therefore I will play no further games. We're going to Camporeon." "Camporeon," said Pellerat, for the moment not remembering. "Surely you recall my friend, the traitor, Munli Kampor? We three met on Seychelles." Pellerat's face assumed a visible expression of enlightenment. "Of course I remember. Camporeon was the world of his ancestors." "If it was. I don't necessarily believe anything Kampor said. But Camporeon is a known world, and Kampor said that its inhabitants knew of Earth. Well then, we'll go there and find out. It may lead to nothing, but it's the only starting point we have." Pellerat cleared his throat and looked dubious. "Oh, my dear fellow, are you sure?" "There's nothing about which to be either sure or not sure. We have one starting point, and however feeble it might be, we have no choice but to follow it up." "Yes, But if we're doing it on the basis of what Compor told us, then perhaps we ought to consider everything he told us. I seem to remember that he told us most emphatically that Earth did not exist as a living planet, that its surface was radioactive, and that it was utterly lifeless. And if that is so, then we are going to Camporeon for nothing. Eight. The three were lunching in the dining room, virtually filling it as they did so. "This is very good," said Pellerat, with considerable satisfaction. "Is this part of our original Terminus supply?" "No, not at all," said Trevise. "That's long gone. This is part of the supplies we bought on Seychelles before we headed out toward Gaia. Unusual, isn't it? Some sort of seafood, but rather crunchy. As for this stuff, I was under the impression it was cabbage when I bought it, but it doesn't taste anything like it." Bliss listened, but said nothing. She picked at the food on her own plate gingerly. Pellerat said gently, "You've got to eat, dear."
"I know, Pell, and I'm eating."
Trevise said, with a touch of impatience he couldn't quite suppress, "We do have Gaian food, Bliss."
"I know," said Bliss, "but I would rather conserve that. We don't know how long we will be out in space, and eventually I must learn to eat isolate food."
"Is that so bad? Or must Gaia eat only Gaia?" Bliss sighed.
"Actually, there's a saying of ours that goes, when Gaia eats Gaia, there is neither loss nor gain. It is no more than a transfer of consciousness up and down the scale. Whatever I eat on Gaia is Gaia, and when much of it is metabolized and becomes me, it is still Gaia. In fact, by the fact that I eat, some of what I eat has a chance to participate in a higher intensity of consciousness, while, of course, other portions of it are turned into waste of one sort or another, and therefore sink in the scale of consciousness."
She took a firm bite of her food, chewed vigorously for a moment, swallowed, and said,
"It represents a vast circulation. Plants grow and are eaten by animals. Animals eat and are eaten. Any organism that dies is incorporated into the cells of molds, decay bacteria, and so on. Still Gaia. In this vast circulation of consciousness, even inorganic matter participates, and everything in the circulation has its chance of periodically participating in a high intensity of consciousness."
"All this," said Trevise, "can be said of any world. Every atom in me has a long history, during which it may have been part of many living things, including human beings, and during which it may also have spent long periods as part of the sea, or in a lump of coal, or in a rock, or as a portion of the wind blowing upon us."
"On Gaia, however," said Bliss, "all atoms are also continually part of a higher planetary consciousness of which you know nothing."
"Well, what happens then," said Trevise, "to these vegetables from Seychelles that you are eating? Do they become part of Gaia?"
"They do, rather slowly, and the wastes they excrete as slowly cease being part of Gaia. After all, what leaves me is altogether lacking in contact with Gaia. It lacks even the less direct hyperspatial contact that I can maintain thanks to my high level of conscious intensity. It is this hyperspatial contact that causes non-Gaian food to become part of Gaia, slowly, once I eat it."
"What about the Gaian food in our stores? Will that slowly become non-Gaian? If so, you had better eat it while you can."
"There is no need to be concerned about that," said Bliss. Our Gaian stores have been treated in such a way that they will remain part of Gaia over a long interval. Pelleret said suddenly,
But what will happen when we eat the Gaian food? For that matter, what happened to us when we ate Gaian food on Gaia itself? Are we ourselves slowly turning into Gaia?
Bliss shook her head, and a peculiarly disturbed expression crossed her face. No, what you ate was lost to us, or at least the portions that were metabolized into your tissues were lost to us. What you excreted stayed Gaia, or very slowly became Gaia, so that in the end the balance was maintained. But numerous atoms of Gaia became non-Gaia as a result of your visit to us.
Why was that? Asked Trevise curiously.
Because you would not have been able to endure the conversion, even a very partial one. You were our guests, brought to our world under compulsion, in a manner of speaking, and we had to protect you from danger, even at the cost of the loss of tiny fragments of Gaia. It was a willing price we paid, but not a happy one.
We regret that, said Trevise. But are you sure that non-Gaian food, or some kinds of non-Gaian food, might not in their turn harm you?
No, said Bliss. What is edible for you would be edible to me. I merely have the additional problem of metabolizing such food into Gaia as well as into my own tissues. It represents a psychological barrier that rather spoils my enjoyment of the food and causes me to eat slowly. But I will overcome that with time.
What about infection? Said Pelleret in high-pitched alarm. I can't understand why I didn't think of this earlier. Bliss, any world you land on is likely to have microorganisms against which you have no defense, and you will die of some simple infectious disease. Trevise, we must turn back.
Don't be panicked, Pell dear, said Bliss, smiling. Microorganisms, too, are assimilated into Gaia when they are part of my food or when they enter my body in any other way. If they seem to be in the process of doing harm, they will be assimilated the more quickly. And once they are Gaia, they will do me no harm.
The meal drew to its end, and Pelleret sipped at his spiced and heated mixture of fruit juices. Dear me, he said, licking his lips, I think it is time to change the subject again. It does seem to me that my sole occupation on board ship is subject changing. Why is that?
Trevise said solemnly, Because Bliss and I cling to whatever subjects we discuss, even to the death. We depend upon you, Genoff, to save our sanity. What subject do you want to change to, old friend?
I've gone through my reference material on Camporeon, and the entire sector of which it is part is rich in legends of age. They set their settlement far back in time, in the first millennium of hyperspatial travel. Camporeon even speaks of a legendary founder named Ben Bali, though they don't say where he came from. They say that the original name of their planet was Ben Bali World.
And how much truth is there in that, in your opinion, Genoff?
A kernel, perhaps. But who can guess what the kernel might be?
I never heard of anyone named Ben Bali in actual history. Have you?
No, I haven't. But you know that in the late imperial era, there was a deliberate suppression of pre-imperial history. The emperors, in the turbulent last centuries of the empire, were anxious to reduce local patriotism, since they considered it, with ample justification, to be a disintegrating influence. In almost every sector of the galaxy, therefore, true history, with complete records and accurate chronology, begins only with the days when Trantor's influence made itself felt and the sector in question had allied itself to the Empire
or been annexed by it.
I shouldn't think that history would be that easy to eradicate, said Trevise.
In many ways it isn't, said Pellerat. But a determined and powerful government can weaken it greatly. If it is sufficiently weakened, early history comes to depend on scattered material and tends to degenerate into folk tales. Invariably, such folk tales will fill with exaggeration and come to show the sector to be older and more powerful than, in all likelihood, it ever really was. And no matter how silly a particular legend is, or how impossible it might be on the very face of it, it becomes a matter of patriotism among the locals to believe it. I can show you tales from every corner of the galaxy that speak of original colonization as having taken place from Earth itself, though that is not always the name they give the parent planet.
What else do they call it?
Any of a number of names. They call it the only, sometimes, and sometimes the oldest. Or they call it the mooned world, which, according to some authorities, is a reference to its giant satellite. Others claim it means lost world, and that mooned is a version of marooned, a pre-galactic word meaning lost or abandoned.
Trevise said gently, Janoff, stop. You'll continue forever with your authorities and counter-authorities.
These legends are everywhere, you say?
Oh, yes, my dear fellow, quite. You have only to go through them to gain a feel for this human habit of beginning with some seed of truth and layering about it shell after shell of pretty falsehood, in the fashion of the oysters of Rampora that build pearls about a piece of grit. I came across just exactly that metaphor once when...
Janoff, stop again.
Tell me, is there anything about Camporeon's legends that is different from others?
Oh.
Pellerat gazed at Trevise blankly for a moment.
Different?
Well, they claim that Earth is relatively nearby, and that's unusual. On most worlds that speak of Earth, under whatever name they choose, there is a tendency to be vague about its location, placing it indefinitely far away, or in some never-never land.
Trevise said, Yes, as some on Seychelles told us that Gaia was located in hyperspace.
Bliss laughed.
Trevise cast her a quick glance.
It's true. That's what we were told.
I don't disbelieve it. It's amusing, that's all. It is, of course, what we want them to believe. We only ask to be left alone right now. And where can we be safer and more secure than in hyperspace? If we're not there, we're as good as there, if people believe that to be our location.
Yes, said Trevise dryly. And in the same way, there is something that causes people to believe that Earth doesn't exist, or that it is far away, or that it has a radioactive crust.
Except, said Pellerat, that the Camporeleans believe it to be relatively close to themselves.
But, nevertheless, give it a radioactive crust. One way or another, every people with an Earth legend consider Earth to be unapproachable.
That's more or less right, said Pellerat.
Trevise said, Many on Seychelles believed Gaia to be nearby. Some even identified its star correctly, and yet all considered it unapproachable. There may be some Camporeleans who insist that Earth is radioactive and dead, but who can identify its star. We will then approach it, unapproachable though they may consider it. We did exactly that in the case of Gaia.
Bliss said, Gaia was willing to receive you, Trevise. You were helpless in our grip, but we had no thought of harming you.
What if Earth, too, is powerful, but not benevolent? What then?
I must in any case try to reach it and accept the consequences. However, that is my task. Once I locate Earth and head for it, it will not be too late for you to leave. I will put you off on the nearest Foundation world, or take you back to Gaia if you insist, and then go on to Earth alone. My dear chap, said Pellerat in obvious distress, don't say such things. I wouldn't dream of abandoning you. Or I of abandoning Pell, said Bliss, as she reached out a hand to touch Pellerat's cheek. Very well, then. It won't be long before we're ready to take the jump to Camporeon, and thereafter, let us hope, it will be on to Earth. Part 2. Camporeon. Chapter 3. At the Entry Station. 9. Bliss, entering their chamber, said, Did Trevise tell you that we are going to make the jump and go through hyperspace any moment now? Pellerat, who was bent over his viewing desk, looked up and said, Actually, he just looked in and told me, within the half hour. I don't like the thought of it, Pell. I've never liked the jump. I get a funny inside-out feeling. Pellerat looked a bit surprised. I had not thought of you as a space traveler, Bliss dear. I'm not particularly, and I don't mean that this is so only in my aspect as a component. Gaia itself has no occasion for regular space travel. By my, our, Gaia's very nature, I, we, Gaia, don't explore, trade, or space junket. Still, there is the necessity of having someone at the entry stations. As when we were fortunate enough to meet you. Yes, Pell. She smiled at him affectionately. Or even to visit Seychelles and other stellar regions for various reasons, usually clandestine. But, clandestine or not, that always means the jump. And, of course, when any part of Gaia jumps, all of Gaia feels it. That's too bad, said Pell. It could be worse. The large mass of Gaia is not undergoing the jump, so the effect is greatly diluted. However, I seem to feel it much more than most of Gaia. As I keep trying to tell Trevise, though all of Gaia is Gaia, the individual components are not identical. We have our differences, and my makeup is, for some reason, particularly sensitive to the jump. Wait, said Pellerat, suddenly remembering. Trevise explained that to me once. It's in ordinary ships that you have the worst of the sensation. In ordinary ships, one leaves the galactic gravitational field on entering hyperspace and comes back to it on returning to ordinary space. It's the leaving and returning that produces the sensation. But the Far Star is a gravitic ship. It is independent of the gravitational field and does not truly leave it or return to it. For that reason, we won't feel a thing. I can assure you of that, dear, out of personal experience. But that's delightful. I wish I had thought to discuss the matter earlier. I would have saved myself considerable apprehension. That's an advantage in another way, said Pellerat, feeling an expansion of spirit in his unusual role as explainer of matters astronautic. The ordinary ship has to recede from large masses such as stars for quite a long distance through ordinary space in order to make the jump. Part of the reason is that the closer to a star, the more intense the gravitational field, and the more pronounced are the sensations of a jump. Then, too, the more intense the gravitational field, the more complicated the equations that must be solved in order to conduct the jump safely, and end at the point in ordinary space you wish to end at. In a gravitic ship, however, there is no jump sensation to speak of. In addition,
This ship has a computer that is a great deal more advanced than ordinary computers, and it can handle complex equations with unusual skill and speed. The result is that instead of having to move away from a star for a couple of weeks just to reach a safe and comfortable distance for a jump, the far star need travel for only 2 or 3 days. This is especially so since we are not subject to a gravitational field and therefore to inertial effects. I admit I don't understand that, but that's what Trevise tells me, and can accelerate much more rapidly than an ordinary ship could. Bliss said,
"That's fine, and it's to Trev's credit that he can handle this unusual ship."
Pellerat frowned slightly. "Please, Bliss, say Trevise."
I do. In his absence, however, I relax a little.
Don't. You don't want to encourage the habit even slightly, dear. He's so sensitive about it.
Not about that. He's sensitive about me. He doesn't like me.
That's not so, said Pellerat earnestly. I talked to him about that. Now, don't frown. I was extraordinarily tactful, dear child. He assured me he did not dislike you. He is suspicious of Gaia and unhappy over the fact that he has had to make it into the future of humanity. We have to make allowances for that. He'll get over it as he gradually comes to understand the advantages of Gaia.
I hope so. But it's not just Gaia. Whatever he may tell you, Pell, and remember that he's very fond of you and doesn't want to hurt your feelings, he dislikes me personally.
No, Bliss, he couldn't possibly.
Not everyone is forced to love me simply because you do, Pell. Let me explain. Trevise, thinks I'm a robot.
A look of astonishment suffused Pellerat's ordinarily stolid features. He said, "Surely he can't think you're an artificial human being."
"Why is that so surprising? Gaia was settled with the help of robots. That's a known fact."
"Robots might help, as machines might, but it was people who settled Gaia, people from Earth. That's what Trevise thinks. I know he does."
"There is nothing in Gaia's memory about Earth, as I told you and Trevise. However, in our oldest memories, there are still some robots, even after 3,000 years, working at the task of completing the modification of Gaia into a habitable world. We were at that time also forming Gaia as a planetary consciousness. That took a long time, Pell dear, and that's another reason why our early memories are dim. And perhaps it wasn't a matter of Earth wiping them out, as Trevise thinks."
"Yes, Bliss," said Pellerat anxiously. "But what of the robots?"
"Well, as Gaia formed, the robots left. We did not want a Gaia that included robots, for we were and are convinced that a robotic component is, in the long run, harmful to a human society, whether isolate in nature or planetary. I don't know how we came to the conclusion, but it is possible that it is based on events dating back to a particularly early time in galactic history, so that Gaia's memory does not extend back to it."
"If the robots left."
"Yes, but what if some remained behind? What if I am one of them? 15,000 years old, perhaps. Trevise suspects that."
Pellerat shook his head slowly. "But you're not."
"Are you sure you believe that?"
"Of course I do. You're not a robot."
"How do you know?"
"Bliss, I know. There's nothing artificial about you. If I don't know that, no one does."
"Isn't it possible I may be so cleverly artificial that in every respect from largest to smallest, I am indistinguishable from the natural. If I were, how could you tell the difference between me and a true human being?
Pellerat said, I don't think it's possible for you to be so cleverly artificial.
What if it were possible, despite what you think?
I just don't believe it.
Then let's just consider it is a hypothetical case. If I were an indistinguishable robot, how would you feel about it?
Well,
To be specific, how would you feel about making love to a robot?
Pellerat snapped the thumb and midfinger of his right hand suddenly. You know, there are legends of women falling in love with artificial men, and vice versa. I always thought there was an allegorical significance to that, and never imagined the tales could represent literal truth. Of course, Golan and I never even heard the word robot till we landed on Seychelles. But now that I think of it, those artificial men and women must have been robots. Apparently, such robots did exist in early historic times. That means the legends should be reconsidered.
He fell into silent thought. And after Bliss had waited a moment, she suddenly clapped her hand sharply. Pellerat jumped. Pell, dear, said Bliss, you're using your mythography to escape the question. The question is, how would you feel about making love to a robot?
He stared at her uneasily. A truly undistinguishable one, one that you couldn't tell from a human being?
Yes.
It seems to me, then, that a robot that can in no way be distinguished from a human being is a human being. If you were such a robot, you would be nothing but a human being to me.
That's what I wanted to hear you say, Pell.
Pellerat waited, then said, Well, then, now that you've heard me say it, dear, aren't you going to tell me that you are a natural human being and that I don't have to wrestle with hypothetical situations?
No, I will do no such thing. You've defined a natural human being as an object that has all the properties of a natural human being. If you are satisfied that I have all those properties, then that ends the discussion. We've got the operational definition and need no other. After all, how do I know that you're not just a robot who happens to be indistinguishable from a human being?
Because I tell you that I am not.
Ah, but if you were a robot that was indistinguishable from a human being, you might be designed to tell me you were a natural human being, and you might even be programmed to believe it yourself. The operational definition is all we have, and all we can have.
She put her arms about Pellerat's neck and kissed him. The kiss grew more passionate and prolonged itself until Pellerat managed to say in somewhat muffled fashion, But we promised Treviz not to embarrass him by converting this ship into a honeymooner's haven. Bliss said coaxingly,
Let's be carried away and not leave ourselves any time to think of promises.
Pellerat, troubled, said, But I can't do that, dear. I know it must irritate you, Bliss, but I am constantly thinking, and I am constitutionally averse to letting myself be carried away by emotion. It's a lifelong habit, and probably very annoying to others. I've never lived with a woman who didn't seem to object to it sooner or later. My first wife... But I suppose it would be inappropriate to discuss that.
Rather inappropriate, yes, but not fatally so. You're not my first lover either.
Oh, said Pellerat, rather at a loss. And then, aware of Bliss's small smile, he said, I mean, of course not. I wouldn't expect myself to have been. Anyway, my first wife didn't like it.
But I do. I find your endless plunging into thought attractive.
I can't believe that. But I do have another thought. Robot or human, that doesn't matter. We agree on that. However, I am an isolate, and you know it. I am not part of Gaia, and when we are intimate, you're sharing emotions outside Gaia, even when you let me participate in Gaia for a short period. And it may not be the same intensity of emotion, then, that you would experience if it were Gaia loving Gaia.
Bliss said, "Loving you, Pell, has its own delight. I look no farther than that."
"But it's not just a matter of you loving me. You aren't merely you. What if Gaia considers it a perversion?"
"If it did, I would know, for I am Gaia. And since I have delight in you, Gaia does. When we make love, all of Gaia shares the sensation to some degree or other. When I say I love you, that means Gaia loves you, although it is only the part that I am that is assigned the immediate role. You seem confused."
"Being an isolate, Bliss, I don't quite grasp it."
"One can always form an analogy with the body of an isolate. When you whistle a tune, your entire body, you as an organism, wishes to whistle the tune. But the immediate task of doing so is assigned to your lips, tongue, and lungs. Your right big toe does nothing."
"It might tap to the tune."
"But that is not necessary to the act of whistling. The tapping of the big toe is not the action itself, but is a response to the action. And, to be sure, all parts of Gaia might well respond in some way or other to my emotion, as I respond to theirs."
Pellerat said, "I suppose there's no use feeling embarrassed about this."
"None at all.
But it does give me a queer sense of responsibility. When I try to make you happy, I find that I must be trying to make every last organism on Gaia happy."
"Every last atom." "But you do. You add to the sense of communal joy that I let you share briefly. I suppose your contribution is too small to be easily measurable, but it is there, and knowing it is there should increase your joy."
Pellerat said, "I wish I could be sure that Golan is sufficiently busy with his maneuvering through hyperspace to remain in the pilot room for quite a while."
"You wish to honeymoon, do you?"
"I do."
"Then get a sheet of paper, write Honeymoon Haven on it, affix it to the outside of the door, and if he wants to enter, that's his problem."
Pellerat did so, and it was during the pleasurable proceedings that followed that the Far Star made the jump. Neither Pellerat nor Bliss detected the action, nor would they have had they been paying attention.
10. It had been only a matter of a few months since Pellerat had met Trevise and had left Terminus for the first time.